Good morning. Good morning. Great to see everybody. Welcome to our service. It's great to have everybody worshiping with us. If you're here this morning as a guest, I especially just want to welcome you to our service. It's great to have you worshiping with us this morning. There is a connection card in the pocket in the chair in front of you. If you'd like to fill that out and drop in the offering plate, we always like to have be able to connect a name with the face, or you can drop it in the offering box, I guess I should say. We don't have an offering plate anymore. But anyway, welcome to our service. It's great to be worshiping together, and welcome to week three of this series and this generosity initiative that we're doing. We're calling it the Tanya Project, and I just want to recap for a little bit for those of you who maybe weren't here last week, or if you missed actually the first couple of weeks of this, and it's all online, so I really encourage you to check it out online and kind of catch up with us, because everything's kind of building on together. But we have a partnership called the Tanya Center. It's in Kenya. It's a school primarily for special needs kids. It's a residential school, and we are wanting to help them kind of get out of this negative financial cycle that they're in, and create some long-term sustainable solutions for them. One of their biggest problems when it comes to managing their finances, one of the biggest issues or financial pulls and drains on what they do, is the cost of electricity in Kenya, and the amount of electricity that they use on campus between the buildings, and they have a water pump that pumps water to irrigate a whole lot of greenhouses and crops, and so that they can feed kids and sell some of the crops for revenue. That costs a whole lot of money for them to do that. And so what ends up happening is several times a year, they will end up getting behind in their electric bill. And the electric company comes and shuts off the power, which means they don't have water pumping anywhere. They don't have power to the classrooms and the dorms. Don't have internet access and all of that good stuff. And they have to forego some of the other things so that they can take all of their resources, put it on getting squared away with the electric company, so they can get the power back on. Which means they aren't necessarily always able to pay their staff and their teachers on a regular basis. That creates a morale problem on campus. It causes really good teachers to end up having to find work other places. When you're dealing particularly with any kind of education, but especially with special needs, you want the best there. And so they certainly want the best there. And so it's just this negative cycle that they tend to be in. So the solution that they've come up with is solar power, and getting the campus on solar power. And we were originally, when we started talking with them about this, we were originally as a church going to try and help them raise funds to get the water pump on the solar power, because it's one of the biggest drains on their energy. It costs about $13,000 a year just to pump water on campus. And then we discovered a group of five churches up in Canada that Joseph and Jennifer were able to connect to this past summer, and actually got to share some of the story of Tanya, and they shared some of this electrical issue with them while they were there. Turns out the pastor of one of those churches, the church has kind of taken the lead on this. He was in the energy world, the corporate world, when he was in his previous career before being a pastor, so he understands sustainable projects. He oversaw a bunch of solar projects in the job that he was in before internationally, and so he's a really neat guy. And so what we're doing is working with these five churches now to actually get all of Tanya on solar power all at one time. It's just going to make more sense. It's going to be cheaper in the long run if we can all do that. So that's pretty cool. I talked in detail about how that kind of came about. It's kind of a God thing in last week's message, and a little bit in this week's newsletter. So if you got either one of those, check those out, and you could hear a little bit more about that. So our total goal as a church for the Tanya Project, this is what our goal has been from day one, is to raise $50,000 over the next 6 months above and beyond what we normally give just to the general operating expenses of our church and the ministries that we do. So $20,000 of that, give or take, is going to go to help with the solar project. And then the Canadian churches are going to attempt to raise the rest of those funds for that. And then $30,000 is we just want to be able to help Tanya with some of their staffing needs and just kind of get a head start going into the new year with some of the costs for hiring teachers and paying teachers and staff. And I said both weeks that I think this is a great goal, because I believe it's big enough that it will require all of us to be participating in some way, but it's small enough that I think as a church we can reach this. I also last week started telling you a little bit about the history of Joseph and Jennifer and the Tanya Center. And I specifically told you how we got connected to them. Again, it's an incredible story that I think only God could work out the details in that story that I told you last week about how our church got connected to Joseph and Jennifer over 35 years ago. We actually helped as a church Joseph get through school here and his master's work because he got over here, lost his funding about halfway through. Our church stepped up because of the connection that he had with a missionary from our church over there. And then Joseph went back to Kenya. We lost track of him for most of those years. I never heard of him until a few years ago when we got reconnected. And for the last 30-plus years, he and Jennifer have been doing some incredible things in Kenya, in the area of education. And so today, I want you to hear a little bit of the vision for Tanya, how that came about, and how Tanya actually became a reality. And I'm going to let Jennifer tell you that herself, because while her and Joseph were here this past summer, we sat down with them, we had a videographer come in, and we captured some of their story on video just so we could use it in the future for retelling that story and helping them with the things that they're doing in Tanya. So Jennifer, she received training as a special education teacher. She became a special ed teacher in Kenya. She taught in a number of schools around Kenya. And then I told you last week, her and Joseph helped start the Karen Institute, a technical institute for the deaf. It was the very first deaf institute beyond high school, beyond secondary school for deaf people. So they helped start it in a little town called Karen. And she taught there and worked there for the last 12 years of her career. And I just want to give you a little bit of the context in this video that I'm going to show you. It's about a six-minute video. It's a little bit hard to understand with her accent and all of that, so I just want to give you some of the context. She talks about them buying a farm. So they bought a farm in an area away from Karen where they were living at the time with the idea that that's where they would retire. They would go back over there about every couple of weeks. And I guess we're building house there and that sort of thing, getting it underway. The farm was in what the Maasai tribe area. There are different tribes in Kenya, and the Maasai tribe, if you've ever seen pictures, they're the ones with the really bright red colors on. And so they met people there, got to know some of the folks in that area. And she talks about her daughter Rose and Rose's friend Joyce, who was a young Maasai girl. Rose was young at this time too. So check out this video of Jennifer telling us some of that story.
My name is Jennifer Kigunda. I am a trained special needs teacher, and I taught in different schools before going to Karen Technical Institute for the Deaf, where I taught for 12 years. And during my teaching in Karen Technical Institute for the Deaf, we bought land where we would retire as a family. And as we continued visiting this farm, my daughter, who was in school by then, became friends with a girl from the community where we had bought land, whose name was Joyce. But Joyce and other siblings in the family were not going to school. So every day, every other weekend, we would visit the farm. Rose would always come home and continue reminding me that she was feeling not happy, that Joyce was her friend and she was not going to school. And she really wanted us as a family to see how we would be able to support Joyce to go to school. And for me, because we had just gotten a loan to buy that farm, as a mother, I realized we didn't have extra funds to pay for the school fees for a friend. And I would always tell her, Rose, we are not ready at the moment, but once we finish paying off our loan, maybe we would be able to support your friend. And I would think by telling Rose this, she would now leave me alone and we would continue repaying our loan. But every other weekend, we would go back to the farm. When we would come back home, Rose would still continue saying, Mom, I'm not feeling well when my friend is not going to school and I'm going to school. So when Rose kept on inquiring from me when I would be able to start helping our friend Joyce, one evening as we were in the kitchen, I told her, Rose, I think it's good for you to understand me as your mom. At the moment, we do not have money. Then as a young girl, she just smiled and said, Mom, Every moment I talk about my friend, you talk about not having money. I would like you to think about, to promise me that if I showed you a way of having money, you will take my friend to go to school. And out of curiosity as a mother, I said, for sure, Rose, if you are a way of getting more money, why would I not take your friend to school? Then she looked at me and smiled and said, Mom, you know that school I go to? I don't think you pay very little money. So what I'm thinking, I would wish you withdraw me from that school, and the amount of money you are paying there, you share it with my friend Rose, and we can go to a school that is not expensive. You know, when I looked at Rose, I had no words, but I found myself shedding tears. I never expected a very young girl of her age to think about the amount of money we spend on our education as parents, and she was willing to share that money with another friend. So I just told her, Rose, thank you that you have given me a solution. Maybe let's wait for your dad and then we can discuss and see what we are going to do about your friend. So when his dad came and I shared what Rose had, he also was surprised because he didn't expect this to happen. So we discussed as a family and thought we should share what Rose had with the school where she used to go. We shared our sentiments with the manager of the school where she was going. And she also felt it was not right for us to withdraw a child from a well-performing school so that we could take her to another school where we could be able to help our friend. So what she did as a first help, and I feel it was the first step for us to start supporting Joyce, she said, maybe what I can do is I would charge you a half of the fees that you are paying for your daughter. Then you can bring in one more child. That's how we are able to support the first Maasai girl, who is Joyce. And that girl was a very smart girl. So she came and went to the same school with our daughter. And by the end of the year, although she was a 10-year-old who had not gone to school, she was able to work her way out because I would do tuition in the evening, and the teacher agreed that we are not placing her with the very small children in class. By the end of the year, our girl was able to read, and she was posted to the next class. Then when the holiday came and we were to take this girl back to her own home at the Maasai place, their mother wanted us to take other three girls so that they could go to school. But then we told her we were not in a position at the moment, but we'd want to take care of Joyce. With the time, we'll see what we'll do to the other girls. By the end of the second year, I was able to talk to another friend who had started a young school around not very far from Karen, and we would take the other two girls and drop them in school and bring them back home to their parents in the evening. By the end of the third year, the other mothers wanted us to take their children. So in the process, the old man who sold land to us and become so close to our family because we had supported three of his children, and he donated a piece of land where we are now able to put up a few classrooms through the retirement of my husband's benefits, to put up three classes where we began the center for the first few children who came to be in the center of Tanya.
I think we have a picture of Joyce and Rose and one of Joyce's sisters when they were little. You know, I watched that video several times, and there's just a couple things I'll point out that Jennifer said that I think are really important for us to understand when we think about where Tanya came from and where that vision came from. And the first is this, that the vision of Tanya started with a child's willingness to sacrifice. It was Rose, just as a kid, who was concerned that her friend Joyce couldn't go to school. And she knew she was going to school and how much that meant to her. I know for us students, that's a foreign idea, right? But she couldn't imagine her friend not being able to go to school. And so it was her that came to her mom and said, Mom, the school you're sending me to, I know it's a better school, but it's a more expensive school. And so if you can send me to a lesser school and a lesser expensive school, you can use that money and Rose and I can go to school together. The second thing that Jennifer points out was, you know, the Maasai family that they bought that farm from, they made a sacrifice. They gave them their land. They entrusted their land to Joseph and Jennifer to start this school. And it was land that was right next door to where Joseph and Jennifer already owned property. And that's the property, that's the extended property of Tanya today. And then the thing that Jennifer said, I think, is really, really important too. And I missed this the first really couple of times that I watched this video. But she talked about when they got the land, they were able to build some schools. And where did it come from? Where did the money come from? It came from Joseph and Jennifer sacrificing. She said they used the money from Joseph's retirement funds to build those first three school buildings. And so time and time again, if you hear their entire story, you'll know that time and time again, they've made those kinds of sacrifices. Joseph and Jennifer, and not just them, but Rose and Eric and their children, through the years, they've sacrificed financially, their comfort, their time, their energy for the children of Tanya. So when we talk about, you know, us making some sacrifices so that we can get to our goal of helping them to see the reality of Tanya and the vision of Tanya to continue and to thrive, then we just need to know that they've paved the way for that. And they continue to make those kinds of sacrifices today. So let's jump back to where we left off last week with what is really the number one goal of this campaign. And it's not $50,000 over 6 months. The number one goal of what we're doing in this series is this. It's our spiritual transformation. That as followers of Jesus, we would grow in some way through all of this spiritually. And I'll be honest with you, as pastor, I don't like talking about money in church. It's just one of those things that sometimes our culture resists, and there's a lot of negative association with it. I believe it's important. I believe it's an important part of our spiritual transformation, which is why I talk about it, because I think it's important. But my biggest fear right now is that you're here today, and you're a first-time guest, or maybe you've been checking this out for just a little bit, and my big fear is that you're a guest. And the reality is we don't talk about money a lot. You just happen to drop in while we're in the middle of this series, so welcome to the series. But if you're here this morning and you're visiting or check us out, you can just sit back and relax and take a deep breath and watch the rest of us kind of sweat and squirm, okay? Because we never ask our guests to give, okay? We want this service to be a gift to you. But anyways, wanted to say that. But grab your notes, open your app. If you got the app and you're using the notes on your app, and let me start this morning just with a question, and it's this. Why do we give money so much power in our lives? Because if we think about it, we do. And so why do we give money so much power in our lives? And I realize not everybody here approaches money the same way. We handle it differently, right? There are some of you here who are cash people, and you just carry cash, and you pay for cash. I won't ask you to raise your hand. I want you to get mugged later or anything like that. Some of us are just credit card people. How many of you, you're like me, you put everything you can on a credit card. Hopefully you're like me, you pay it off at the end of the month, and you just get all the points, right? You're just after the points. Travel points, cash points, whatever, gas points, whatever you can get for free, you're up for that, right? And then there's some of us, you know, we eat out, and some of you eat at Ruth Chris Steakhouse, and others of us, we just eat for free at Costco on Saturday afternoons, right? Anybody there with me on that one? Lots of us love shopping over at Tyson's Mall, and some of us just love a good yard sale bargain, right? In fact, some of you are probably yard sale, garage sale addicts. Anybody want to, you know, raise your hand on that one? Okay, if you've ever held up something and said, this is only a nickel, okay, then you probably have a problem, okay? You're probably a garage sale addict or shopper. Anyway, there are some of you, and I've said this before, some of you, you balance your checkbook, I know, because you've told me every month, right? And you will chase down a penny if you can't find it until you find it, won't you? And you won't just do like I do and just add the penny in, right? You will go and find out what happened to that penny. And then others of us, let's just be honest. I mean, we just shut the account down about every 2 years, right? And go to another bank and just start completely from scratch, right? But regardless of your money tendencies, I think there's a universal perception of about money. And the perception is this, that if I have money, that money promises security, freedom, and peace. that money promises security, freedom, and peace. And who doesn't want those things, right? I mean, we all want security, freedom, and peace. But the problem is money usually oversells itself. So what I want to do today is I want to show you four phases of generosity. What does it look like when we, as followers of Jesus, when we grow towards generosity? What does that process look like? And these are four phases that I think just the typical follower of Jesus goes through when they are growing in the area of generosity. It's just a part of the spiritual transformation process that we're talking about as part of the series in this area of our lives. And so here's the first phase in the growth towards generosity. It's the if only phase. It's the if only phase. Everybody starts out in this phase, and we usually start out in childhood, right? When I was a kid, I've told you about my friend Scott before, I think, but when I was a friend, I had a really, really good friend named Scott. And Scott and I think became friends, I think, around fifth grade. We lived in the same neighborhood, just a few doors down, went to the same school. Scott went to the same church as I went to. And so we were together all the time, and we were really good friends. And we were kids. Scott got a brand new candy apple red Schwinn bicycle for his birthday. And Scott was one of those kind of kids that kind of bragged about things and pointed things out. And so he's always bragging about this. And I loved biking. It was something, I was an ADD kid, so I had lots of energy. So I was always on my bike and all. And I had a bike too. I had a Huffy, okay? And if you were my age and liked bikes back then, you know that Schwinn's were like three times as nice as a Huffy. I mean, you could get a Huffy for about $25, not on sale at your local Kmart, okay? And that's the bike that I had. And Scott had a Schwinn, and man, if only I had a Schwinn like Scott had. And then when Scott was a little bit older, he and I got to be about like sixth grade, seventh grade, something like that. He got to upgrade his bike to like a 10-speed. Remember the round handlebars? You had little levers that changed the gears and all of that stuff. And again, it was a really nice bike. I mean, it was a lightweight racing type bike, and he would always point that out, how much faster his bike was and all this stuff. And I kept trying to talk my parents into, if only I had a 10-speed, I could keep up with Scott and I wouldn't be on this Huffy anymore. And finally I talked my parents into it, but it wasn't too long before I began to think again, if only I had something else, if only I could maybe take these training wheels off this bike, I could keep up with Scott a little bit better in life or something. But here's the deal. If only is the operating term for what I call the search for it. The search for it. If only I had it, whatever it is. And when I moved into high school, if only had a different look to it. It was called girls, right? And if only I had a girlfriend. If only I could just get a date, If only I could date Carmen. If only she wasn't dating Scott. That would be great, wouldn't it? And actually, I did date Carmen for a short time. I don't know how. Maybe it was good fortune, luck, pity. My parents might have paid hers. I'm not really sure about that. And I'm not saying anything bad about Carmen or anything, but she was a nice person and all that. But it didn't take me very long to know this isn't it, okay? And maybe it was because her dad was the vice principal of our high school, and he was like 6'6" and weighed 280 pounds, and he went by the name of Mr. T because his last name was Thomas. But he looked a little bit like Mr. T. He was kind of tough. And, now obviously I was it for her, but that's a whole other story for another sermon some other day, right? And I could give you a whole lot more stories and examples of my if only phase, but I probably said enough and I probably embarrassed myself enough. But I bet this, I bet most of us are sitting here going, I know the if only phase. I know that search for it. Some of you may be saying, I'm in the if only phase, right now. If only I could get into that college or have that GPA, if only I had that job, or if only I could have that office, or if I could make all of the decisions in my company or on my team, if only we could afford that house or live in that neighborhood, and then we get it, right? I mean, we get the job, we get the house, we get the next new gadget, whatever it is that we want, and then we have to stop and we go, this isn't it. Right? This isn't doing it for me. The word I want you to write next to if only is the word more. Because the reality is that term really identifies the if only stage. If only I had more, right? If only I had more. And you might want to take your pencil if you're writing or write it in your notes and just put a circle around that and then a cross through it, because that's the international sign for no. And so now it's no more, right? If only I had no more. And some of you, you might need to write that down and put it somewhere where you will see it regularly. You might want to write it down and put it on your refrigerator or put it on your mirror, tape it to the dashboard of your car, shave it into the side of your dog or cat or something, somewhere where you will see it every day as a reminder, hey, in life, I don't really need any more. You know, thousands of years ago, a guy by the name of Solomon, we talk about Solomon a lot. Solomon was King David's son. He was king of Israel, and he was king of Israel in Israel's heyday, when they were at the top of when they would ever be, the golden years. And Solomon, he had more than anybody in the world had. He had more stuff. He had more relationships. He had more power and prestige and all of that. And here's what Solomon writes when he's talking about this if-only phase that we all go through. He said this, "Those who love money, they'll never have enough. How absurd to think that wealth brings true happiness," Solomon says. And the fact is, you cannot move from phase one to phase two in the journey to generosity until you understand the truth of that verse. That if only, it just doesn't work. And then here's the second phase. It's the say what phase. And this is where, as followers of Jesus, we begin to learn what God has to say to us about this. And we learn that God cares about our life, and that God cares about our finances, and that God cares what we do with our life, and that God cares what we do with our finances. So what does God have to say about our finances? What does he say about money? I want us to look at one verse this morning where Jesus himself said this. He said, "Don't store up treasures here on earth where they can be eaten by moths and get rusty, and where thieves break in and steal. Wherever your treasure is, there your heart and your thoughts will be also." Jesus is saying in this passage, he's saying, you were made for eternity. You and I, we are going to live a lot longer on the other side of eternity than on this side. And Jesus is saying, in eternity, you're not going to have the treasures that you have here on earth. You're not going to take those with you. He says, they're just going to turn into piles of rust. And when you get to heaven, here's the deal. When you get to heaven, nobody's going to come up to you and say, "Hey, when you were on earth, what was your pile of rust?" And you're going to go, "It was a Series 5 BMW. And they're going to go, "Wow, that's a lot better than my pile of rust. It was just a Schwinn," right? That's not going to happen. There's not going to be any status when we get to heaven attached to the stuff that we have here. It's just going to be a pile of rust, and we move on. And Jesus says the rust stays here. Jesus says our stuff is vulnerable. He says it's going to wear out. So build your life. If you build your life around stuff, if you build your life around treasures on earth, he says you're building it on the wrong thing. He says if you want to make the most of what you've got, and if you want to really live life to the fullest, then he says store up treasures in heaven, in eternity, where you're going to spend all of your eternity. And let me show you a picture of what I think in just a second. What I think this looks like. This is just one image that comes to my mind, particularly when we talk about vulnerable children in the context of what we're talking about here. But I think it's a powerful, powerful picture of what Jesus is saying in this verse, and it's this picture right here. Now, if Joseph was here, Joseph would tell you he would rather have 1,000 pictures like that than all of the money in the world, than a comfortable house and a comfortable retirement and the ability to travel. He would take 1,000 pictures like that over any of that stuff. And I think he and Jennifer are living out their lives. They're storing up treasures in heaven with what they're doing. And I thought about them, and I thought about their lives, and I thought about this verse that Jesus said, and I thought, can you imagine the line when they get to heaven? Can you imagine the line of people, of kids, of adults who were kids at Tanya that they invested in that nobody else wanted to invest in? That they took in that nobody else would take in? That they educated that either nobody else could educate or thought they could even be educated, and they took them in and they taught them and they educated them and they rehabilitated them from the issues that they grew up with. I mean, can you imagine a line of people when they get there that just want to say, "Thank you for investing in me. Thank you for leaving a treasure on this side of eternity." They are living out this verse. So how do we do that? As followers of Jesus, how do we store up treasures in heaven? Well, Jesus says you give away the treasures here to things that God is doing on this earth. And that stores it up for heaven. You invest in things that are going to last. So the if only phase, we all go through that. We start out there. The say what phase, we learn what God says. And then the third phase, this is a little bit tougher one. And in fact, it might be the toughest of all. It's the what if phase. And this is where we go, you know, if only didn't work. You know, I didn't find meaning there. I kept looking for it. I kept achieving. I kept saving. I kept buying. I kept doing all this. I'd get it, but it didn't bring me what I was looking for. And so I said, God, what do you want me to do? What do you want to do here? And I see what he wants me to do. He wants me to give it away and invest in things that will last into eternity. Because God knows that when he has my finances, he has all my stuff, he has my heart, and God ultimately just wants my heart. And so you're kind of ready, but then you go, what if, right? I mean, what if I don't have enough money and I give it away? What if I add up all my bills at the end of the month and my bills equal more than I make? What if? What if something happens and I lose my income and how much money that I have? What if something happens and there's a financial crisis or a medical emergency or something comes up that's unanticipated? What if? And like I said last week, what ifs are fueled by fear. That's what it is. It's just fear. And let's be honest, the fear is legitimate, isn't it? I mean, the what ifs in life, they can be real things that are real concerning to us. The fear is real. And like I said last week, I don't think Christians don't give because they're greedy. I think the reason most of us don't give is we're just afraid and we're just fearful. And I understand that because I've been down this road and I go down this road myself. My fear kicks in and I really have to think and I really have to pray. And do I really believe God is who he says he is? And do I really believe that God will do what he says he will do in this area of my life? But the more I follow God and the more that I learn from what he says in Scripture, the more I realize that I shouldn't be afraid of giving too much. I really ought to be afraid of giving too little. Because I should fear that there will come a day when I stand before God and I try to explain to him why I wanted to be a follower of Jesus, but I wanted to hold on in this one area of my life and not trust him there. And Jesus said something really, really interesting. And I think this verse should probably make every one of us who consider ourselves followers of his very, very nervous. He said this, "Much is required from those to whom much is given, for their responsibility is greater." Another way of saying that is to whom much is given. To whom much is given, much is expected. And here's something I came across this week. It just really kind of made me stop and think and really kind of brought that verse home in terms of what we're talking about with vulnerable people in the world. And it's this: if you have food in a refrigerator, clothes on your back and a roof over your head and a place to sleep, you are more comfortable than 75% of this world. More comfortable than 75% in this world. That's all of us here today. Here's another way of saying it. If you have money in the bank, or in your wallet, if you have spare change in a drawer or in your pocket, you're among the top 8% of the world's most wealthy people. That is every one of us. Middle and high school students who are here, that is you. You are in the top 8% of the world's most wealthiest people because we all have change in our pocket, don't we? And remember what I told you on the first week, on week one? I asked Joseph about some of the cost of Tanya, the annual cost and what it takes and the big pulls on them. And it was electricity and food and it was staff. And I said, what does it cost there in terms of staff and teachers and all? $150 a month is the average pay to the people who are working and serving at Tanya. Folks, we have been given so, so much just by the fact that we were born in this country or live here now. We have been given so, so much. And Jesus said, not me, I didn't say this. Jesus said, much is expected of us. And so here's the fourth phase, the fourth step towards generosity. It's the I will phase. And this is when we get to the point in our spiritual transformation where we say, okay, I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to trust God with my finances. and I'm going to take a step of faith, whatever that looks like for me. You fight through the fear, you push through the what ifs, and you say, God, I'm going to begin trusting you with my finances, and I'm going to start with that percentage giving that we talked about last week, or God, you know, percentage giving, that no longer challenges me financially. I've got that down, and so it's built into my budget and my lifestyle and all of that. So God, I'm going to need to start trusting you in a different way and in a new way. Solomon tells us this. He says, honor the Lord by giving him the first part of your income, and he will fill your barns with wheat and barley and overflow your wine vats with the finest wines. And I realize that verse, the metaphors in that verse there aren't necessarily really attractive to us. I mean, wheat and barley, the wine stuff might be attractive to a lot of you here. But the promise of that verse, the promise of that verse is blessing. And the promise is this. God says, I'm going to fill it up. I'm going to give you what you need. I am going to make a provision for you if you will trust me in this area of your life. So those are four phases that I think we all go through, and we're probably all at different phases in our life and in our spiritual journey, and maybe you've identified which phase that you're in this morning. But as you move towards generosity, as you take steps through some of these phases, and you kind of wrestle with God on your own and within the context of a couple if you're married or with your family, I just want to give you, as we wrap up, just some really quick practical steps, action steps that I think you ought to just think about in terms of processing a lot of what we're talking about in this series. And the first one is this. You've got to start by designing a plan. You've got to start by designing a plan. And we're going to talk about this in detail next week, what that plan might look like for us. But here's the deal. You don't just drift into generosity. You don't just wake up one morning going, hey, I've got all this peace and my bills are paid and I've got a savings account and I'm giving to the work of God. That just doesn't happen automatically. You've got to have a plan. So next week, we're going to talk about what that might look like. And then here's the second thing I would have you just to consider, just to think about, is giving until it requires faith. You're giving until it requires faith. You know, for some of you, a tenth to think about that, that requires a tremendous amount of faith. For some of you here, less than that would require a tremendous amount of faith on your part. At that point, I'd say, great, that's requiring faith of you. Why don't you take a breather for a second while I talk to a smaller portion of people that I know who are here that let's just be honest, 10% just doesn't require faith anymore. And I'll be honest with you, 10% doesn't require faith for Marcia and I anymore. And I don't say that in a boastful way at all. I just say that because we both learned to tithe and give back to God when we were little kids. And it's always been a part of our life, and it's always been a part of our marriage, and it's always been a part of our family. And so our lifestyle and our budget and all that is just kind of, it's just been molded around that through the years. And so 10% doesn't really challenge us that much anymore. For some of you here, your tithe, your giving, it's routine, and you don't even think about it anymore, and it's safe, and it doesn't really require any faith of you. And so I want to challenge you to push yourself every once in a while, and generosity initiatives like this are great opportunities to do that, but every once in a while to push yourself to a place of being uncomfortable, okay? Now, I'm not saying push yourself to a place of being stupid, okay? I'm saying push yourself to a place of being a little uncomfortable where it might just not feel so good. And I'll tell you why I say that. The greatest times in my life spiritually, the times that I think I've seen the some of the best spiritual transformation in my life personally, not just in the area of finances, but in a lot of areas, have been the times when I've pushed myself to being uncomfortable and it required faith for me to take the next step. Whatever step that was, those were the times that God showed up. And those were the times when I learned more about trusting God than I could in any other way, where it was a little bit above and beyond what the normal expectation of me was. One last thing, whether you're a guest this morning, a longtime attender, whether you've made a financial commitment as a part of your faith, you give every week or once a month, or you're just now starting to think about it at all, wherever you are, here's one last thing I would just ask all of us to consider, and it's this. Celebrate your worth. You need to celebrate your worth. Do you know how much you're worth? And I'm not talking about your financial. I'm not talking about your net worth. I'm talking about your life worth. Do you know how much your life is worth? Do you know how much your house is worth? Your house is worth exactly what somebody's willing to pay for it. And the same is true for you and me. Our lives are worth exactly what somebody is willing to pay for. And I believe that you and I believe we were purchased at an incredible, incredible price. Peter, who was one of Jesus' closest followers, but not just that, one of Jesus' closest friends. He was in the inner circle with Jesus through Jesus' ministry. Here's what Peter tells us. He says, you were bought, not with something that ruins like gold or silver. It was the costly sacrifice of Christ. Peter says, Jesus paid for your life with his. And he says, I know, because I was there, and I saw it, and I was an eyewitness to it. And that's how much you're worth. And you should celebrate that and what God has done. Let me show you one more verse, and then we'll wrap up. It's this. Ecclesiastes, Solomon says, enjoy what you have rather than desiring what you don't have. Because just dreaming about nice things is meaningless. He says it's like chasing after the wind. So you want to make the most of your life. You want to live a life that's fulfilled. Then give God from the first and not the leftovers. Give to the work of God on this earth and store up treasures in heaven where they will last. And then see what God does in and through you in the process. Let me pray for you. God, I thank you for this opportunity just to talk about some of the things that you say about our finances, but more importantly, what you say about us and how much we are valuable to you and how much you want our hearts connected to your heart. But God, we know that you don't have our hearts until you have everything, all the areas of our life, including our stuff. So God, help us to take some time this week to think about some of the things we've been talking about and how we might need to take a next step of trusting you in this area of generosity so that we can grow in our spiritual transformation. God, I thank you for Joseph and I thank you for Jennifer. I thank you for that story that Jennifer told us this morning of how Tanya was actually born out of the heart of a child and how that child wanted to sacrifice what they had so that some other child could have the education that they needed. God, I thank you for all of the people, all of the kids and all the adults who have come through Tanya and have been affected because of it. Their lives have been changed because of the love and the acceptance that they've experienced there, because they found people there who, regardless of their circumstances as kids and where they came from and the baggage they had, there were people there who believed in them and helped them to take the next steps. So God, help us to move to a point of maybe being a little uncomfortable in this area in our life, whatever that looks like for us. In Christ's name I pray, amen. We're going to sing our song response in just a minute. And before we do, I just want to point you to the cards that you were given on your way in. We gave them to you last week. We'll have them available next week too. And I asked you last week just to take these and to begin thinking about and praying about as individuals, as couples, as families, maybe have some conversations with each other, with your kids if they're old enough, about, you know, where are we going to fall on this generosity initiative with Tanya? Are we going to be a part of this? Is God leading us to be a part of this in some ways? And where does that put us? We're asking people to bring these back next week if you plan to participate and sign. And even if you're just participating in prayer, let me tell you, nobody needs prayer like the folks at Tanya, because they work day in and day out in some of the most difficult circumstances. And if there's anything we should be doing, it's praying for them. They are at the top of our staff's prayer list. We pray for them every Tuesday morning when we're in staff meeting. And that might be how you participate. But however you plan to participate, we're asking you to bring these cards back so that we can get an idea of where we are as we wrap up this series next week with this initiative so that we can begin letting Tanya know and our partners in Canada and all that. You can bring them back and just drop them in one of the offering boxes in the back. If you're not going to be here next week and you want to fill one out, you can drop them off today. A number of our staff and leaders are traveling and have already filled ours out and dropped theirs in. And they're already committed to what we're doing here. So let me encourage you to do that. Along the way, if you have any questions about the project itself and the details of that, I would be happy to talk more about it. If you have any questions about any of the spiritual stuff that we're talking about, because we're covering a lot of ground in 4 weeks, I'd love to have some conversations about that with you. But whatever questions you have, bring them to us. Let's stand and sing our song response.